it'll be fascinating to see how Amazon's prototype navigates the street. You know, if it's truly supposed to be autonomous, what happens when it gets up to a stoplight?
I don't have a lot of faith in teenagers, I guess. Could you imagine this thing rolling down the street and kids on their bike riding up to it? Hey, I mean, Lime bikes end up in the lake. What do you think is going to happen to a little scout rolling into your apartment complex or whatever?
Yeah, it's like the digital generation's cow tipping.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to GeekWire. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop.
I'm civic editor Monica Nicholsberg.
And I'm Geek Life reporter Kurt Schlosser.
Making his triumphant return to the show.
Hello.
We've missed you.
Kurt, you had a great interview on the podcast recently with some dude who would only use his flip phone, and here you are now in the big time.
Yeah, flip phone guy. He hasn't called.
He hasn't texted either. He hasn't sent any gifts your way. Hey, we've got some fun stuff to talk about this week and some meaningful stuff. I want to start with the surprise from Amazon of the week, and that is the rollout of the autonomous delivery robot named Scout, which Monica...
It's very confusing.
Monica's got a dog named Scout.
Who comes to the GeekWire office every day, so she's been really flustered by this news.
And, you know, I first saw it and I thought, wait a second, Scout was the name of the first treasure truck, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, was it?
So it must be a popular name. But if for people who missed this story, it is basically a cooler-sized robot on six wheels that rolls around and it's autonomous, but the whole idea is that it can deliver goods, items that you order on Amazon, to your door, essentially, although it calls you to come on out and get it. Amazon is testing this in Snohomish County, north of Seattle, and they have six of them. They're package delivery robots. And this is just the latest example of Amazon trying to solve what is known in the e-commerce world and the shipping world as the last mile.
Last mile.
But it's not so good yet to that they can do it just on their own. They have to have people walking along with them during this test period. Is this the future? Is it a novelty? What do you think of this?
I was messing with Nat Levy yesterday, who wrote that story as it was breaking. I said, hurry up and write that so I can make fun of it, which I never circled back to do because I feel like I make fun of Amazon a little too much. But I like the idea of solving this problem of too many trucks on the road or fossil fuel burning vehicles that are, hauling packages around our neighborhoods. And, and if it's electric robots or it's electric drones or whatever that can sort of simplify that process or solve that, or even if it's bicycles like UPS is turning to in Seattle, I'm all for it. But I said to Nat, the first thing I said was, how's that thing get up my porch steps? And so, all right, now I got to be home to accept the package. It's a big enough problem when I'm not home and packages are stolen. So now I've got this cooler looking thing that rolls up and calls me and says, come on outside, you've got a package.
Yeah, and I feel like that's... some of those things can be worked out, but it seems like there's a more fundamental problem here, which is that I can only see this robot really working in cities, and my understanding is that cities are not really where that last mile challenge is so confounding. I think it's harder in rural areas that are served by the U.S. Postal Service, but not really any other shippers, to get the packages to the people's doorsteps, and I can't really see one of these tiny robots going like miles and miles through a rural area. So it seems designed for cities where there are a lot of options, including bike couriers and other ways that it's not that hard to deliver packages to the door.
I agree with you, though, Kurt. The whole notion of getting rid of these giant trucks, of scaling this down. Now, of course, this is basically doing one or two packages, I would assume, as opposed to the giant well that's in the back of the UPS truck. Mm-hmm. But I like the idea of the small, efficient, energy efficient and environmentally friendly way of doing it. That's kind of cool. I also like that Amazon is doing this in the Seattle region, and that's kind of my own personal thing. But one of my concerns with HQ2 is that Amazon will start doing a lot of this prototype testing elsewhere in the country. And frankly, maybe I'm just a geek this way, but I love the fact that we get to see things first here, like Amazon Fresh Pickup, the Treasure Truck, Amazon Go. And maybe that isn't a widespread concern for anybody but me.
Yeah, I guess it depends where the executive team is, but it's hard for me to imagine them no longer doing that testing in Seattle. Maybe it's just because it's always been done that way, but I don't know. I can't see an Amazon Fresh pickup or one of these tiny robots rolling around Northern Virginia.
Well, you never, I mean, New York, I mean, yeah. Where else, if it plays in the big city, in the Big Apple, right? You know?
That's true, but New York is also pretty unique. It's, I think Seattle is more similar to a wider range of mid-sized cities.
Yeah. What was the name of that retail store that they opened in New York? Oh, gosh, it was the one where it's all the popular Amazon products. It'll come to me. But it was an alternative retail store. Yeah, I'll figure it out.
Scout.
Sure. Anyway, so that was kind of cool. This is a concept that many different startups have tried, this idea of sort of the ice chest on wheels that travels around. One of the startups that I saw that was doing this at CES a couple years ago, the Consumer Electronics Show, their big issue was traffic lights. So it'll be fascinating to see how Amazon's prototype navigates the street. You know, if it's truly supposed to be autonomous, what happens when it gets up to a stoplight?
Yeah, I'm also curious whether this will go the way of drone delivery, where, I mean, I don't know what the latest I heard on that was, but I felt like it was supposed to be making more traction than it is now, or if it'll actually become something that we see on our streets and delivering our packages.
I think the FAA regulations are a big part of the issue there in the U.S. and why Amazon is doing the initial actual commercial deployments of drones in the U.K.
I think it relies, I don't have a lot of faith in teenagers, I guess. Could you imagine this thing rolling down the street and
no.
Kids on their bike riding up to it? Hey, you know, certainly these are probably being deployed from a larger vehicle that's not far away. Sort of like drones will come back to a mother vehicle and get a package and then fly off. But man, look, I mean, Lime bikes end up in the lake. What do you think is going to happen to a little Scout rolling into your apartment complex or whatever?
Yeah, it's like the digital generation's cow tipping.
I think about this, if you think about the ultimate manifestation of this vision, will we have just little robots cruising down every sidewalk? Oh, yeah, there goes the Amazon robot, just like you would maybe see the FedEx or the UPS truck. And oh, yeah, there goes the Walmart robot, you know, delivering to, I don't know.
I think there's a reason they made it so cute. I mean, it's kind of a scary concept, but you look at this little blue, like, it's just adorable. It's this little blue munchkin robot that rolls on by, and who wouldn't want to see that?
And it's got the little Amazon smiley face underneath the Prime
totally
logo.
Totally innocuous.
So it must be great, right? Everybody's happy. All right, so that is the new Amazon autonomous package delivery robot. So autonomous, so this thing is self-driving. The whole idea is that it would go down the sidewalk without any direct control, although clearly they do have to have some kind of human intervention at this point. It's called Scout, and it's being tested in Snohomish County, north of Seattle. I wonder why Snohomish County.
Yeah, that struck me too.
Yeah, a little odd. But here's the thing. If you've seen one of these, let us know at tips@geekwire.com. We prefer video, photos. If you can get an interview with this autonomous robot, that's a plus. Or the human companion of the robot. But seriously, we've been trying to track it down. We have not yet found it as of this recording, but there are 6 of them deployed up in Snohomish County. All right, so that is our first news story. We're going to take a break. We will be right back on The Week in Geek. You're listening to GeekWire.
I wanted a career in IT, but I didn't know where to start. WGU makes it simple. Their accredited online degree programs cover all kinds of IT specialties, and they have valuable industry certifications built in at no extra cost. The payoff? Having those certs back up my degree makes me look even better to future employers. A nonprofit university that includes top industry certs in their programs? I choose WGU. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
Welcome back to GeekWire. It's Todd Bishop with Monica Nicholsberg and Kurt Schlosser. We are talking about the biggest headlines of the week on GeekWire and the broader world of technology. Monica, you were tracking some technology that actually helped to influence the outcome of the election in a legal way during the midterms.
Yes.
Tell us this story.
Sure. So we learned that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, now a congresswoman from New York, used a new app, and it really helped her campaign and helped her cinch the really historic primary victory that she won over an incumbent who had held the seat for 2 decades. You know, everyone predicted that she wasn't going to win, and it was 3 weeks from the primary. She was down in the polls, and two members of her campaign's tech team developed this app that is now been formally called Reach. At the time, it didn't have a name. And it allowed them to canvass voters a lot more effectively. And it actually really moved the needle on their voter turnout and engagement.
So this app, what exactly does it do to enable this? And are there privacy implications of collecting voter information? Tell us about this app.
Sure. So the traditional way that grassroots canvassing happens is campaigns have these voter lists that are kind of, it's a hit list of voters who seem likely to be persuaded to vote for their candidate. And they'll either knock on doors or use an app to, you know, text or dial these folks. But they're kind of seeing diminishing returns. And if you've ever been contacted by a campaign, you might know that you're not always that inclined to talk to them. But what they found was that while their volunteers were getting kind of weary of those traditional tactics, they were constantly out at events, talking politics and meeting people, often people who were supporters, but they didn't really have any way to record their information so that they could follow up with them and so that the campaign could add them to their database. So this app is a search engine of a campaign's entire voter database. And anywhere you are, you can whip it out. If you're talking to somebody, you can look them up really quickly, survey them, record data about them. And it's just a way to canvass in a more natural kind of, by more natural means.
So did it really help her win? Or was it one of those things that was just a little bit more soft in terms of the way that it impacted the campaign? Like, they feel that it impacted and helped her engage with voters, but are they able to quantify it?
They are, actually, yeah. So of all of the likely AOC voters that they contacted during the campaign, 15% were contacted using this app. And of the people contacted using Reach, they saw a 14% higher voter turnout than those who were contacted by traditional means. So those are pretty significant numbers.
Interesting. So this is now rolling out to other people. I'm sure this is going to both Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians. They're sharing this broadly, right, to improve the general state of democracy?
Nope, not at all. No, but it is spreading. So after they developed this app and saw these meaningful results, they weren't necessarily planning to roll it out into a startup, but they started getting contacted from campaigns all over the country because the kind of world of very progressive politics is pretty tight-knit, including a candidate who's now running for Seattle City Council named Sean Scott. He described it as this legendary app that he'd just heard murmurings about and wanted to use in his campaign. So they decided it was worthwhile enough to start their own business called Reach, and it was used, a beta version of it was used in 14 different campaigns during the midterms. But there is a catch. It's only available to Democrats, and in general elections, any Democrat can use it, but in primaries, it's only being made available to candidates who've sworn off corporate donations.
Wow, interesting. It's kind of like technology is a hammer, like, or a lever, I guess.
Maybe yes, would be, yeah, a more they're innocuous not shy phrase. About their goal. Their ambition is to enable progressive politicians to have more leverage up against corporate donations, basically. So it's really interesting to see this spread, to see the local element of a city council candidate using it. And I'm just curious to see where this goes, because it kind of reminds me of the way that the Obama campaign used a lot of technology and grassroots organizing in order to make a real difference. And he was also kind of an underdog candidate in the beginning, like AOC.
Are we going with AOC?
It's a lot easier to say.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Not that that's hard.
What's so hard about that?
It just takes time, you know?
I like it. I like your story. And initially when I saw it, I thought it was in this context. But in the context of her larger sort of internet presence that she is mastering in these first few weeks of her term in Congress and getting recognition for.
Yeah, it's actually really fascinating what she's been able to do with technology. And it's something that other progressive candidates are definitely looking at and trying to emulate. This is something I chatted with Sean Scott about, too. I don't know if you follow her on Instagram, Todd.
No, I don't.
But she has a really personal, casual, kind of, a lot of people say it's a very authentic presence where she'll, you know, be reading congressional documents and making instant ramen on an Instagram story and just talking directly to her followers about the fact that she still doesn't make a lot of money and she is eating cheap food, and or she'll do like a, you know, a video carpool karaoke in the car, or just, you know, record her road trips. It feels like she could be your friend telling you about what it's like to go to Congress.
And then you combine that kind of personal engagement with actual data. That's pretty powerful.
It is. And I think that it really speaks to younger voters who feel like there's this big gap between them and their elected officials. And her whole thing is narrowing that gap.
I still come back to the privacy issue. Like, if you're sitting there and you're a voter and you're talking with the representative of somebody, or perhaps even the candidate herself, I can't imagine her pulling out her smartphone and filling in the database. But still, I'd be like, you know, I'm happy to consider voting for you, but I'll give you my vote, not my data.
It's funny that you should mention that, because I think a lot of people don't realize how much publicly available voter data there is. I wrote about another app earlier this year called Vote With Me, and it's pretty fascinating. It uses your contacts to search the voter database, and it can tell you which friends and family members have voted in the past election and previous elections, whether they voted Democrat or Republican. And so you can even search through and see, like, I want to identify my friends and relatives who are in districts where there might be a swing seat, or they might be able to make the make a difference, close districts. I want to see if they've voted like me in the past, and then I want to send them a message saying, hey, I just want to remind you to vote in this election. So there's actually a lot of this information that's already out there, even though it might feel a little invasive.
Interesting. All right. Well, that's great. Now, that obviously is one story of the season. Congress is back in session. The government is not running, but this whole new wave of representatives, including AOC, are in office and obviously making lots of headlines. Another moment of the season right now is NFL playoffs. Kurt,
Here we are.
You covered one of the stories from the weekend that you almost need to see the video of Bill Belichick throwing the Microsoft Surface. But describe what happened in the Patriots game this past weekend.
Yeah, it's almost like we watch these games now. Once our beloved Seahawks have been eliminated, it's necessary to sort of keep an eye on whether there are tech angles for us that kind of manifest themselves in these games, and certainly it did with last Sunday's game between the Patriots and the Chiefs. And it's a familiar story, because the Microsoft sideline technology has come up in these stories before, because it's an easy thing for players and coaches to take their frustrations out on when things aren't going right. Much different than the printed out black and white photos that they used to look at on the sidelines. Now they've got this tablet in hand. And Bill Belichick has been vocal in the past about his disdain for these things and for the technology, but he was using it on Sunday, and a call didn't go his way, and he slammed the thing into the turf, picked it up, took a few steps, and then hurled it over his bench into the crowd.
I was going to say, did it actually go into the stands?
The camera didn't track the flight of the Surface Pro. It just kind of followed Bill as he turned back around with his hoodie on and watched the game. But it was enough to get some reaction on Twitter, obviously, including from Panos Panay, the Microsoft hardware chief, and he kind of did a video grab of his television and was like, and then he throws it. And it was just him laughing in the background was like a nice Microsoft reaction. But he did tweet that, don't worry, we test for this sort of treatment.
See, I love that spin, because in the past, the reason that Bill Belichick has thrown those things is because he was frustrated, I believe, with the technology. It wasn't giving him what he wanted. Here, I think he was just frustrated with this situation. And so then it becomes a stress test of the hardware. Oh, don't worry. If you get one of these, you know, you can throw it at all you want, stomp on it, and it'll be fine.
I think Microsoft should definitely do a Super Bowl ad around that sort of.
Oh, my God. Well, if they're not, they should be.
Yeah, whether it's with stand-in players or whether it's real footage, I think they could have some fun with it. And fun with themselves.
That's great. All right, those are a couple of the news stories that caught our attention this past week. We will be right back with the Random Channel. You're listening to GeekWire.
This GeekWire podcast is sponsored in part by Yale University Press. Are you concerned about the rise of AI and how it will impact our society? Every day, artificial intelligence presents us with urgent ethical challenges. How do we harness this extraordinary technology to empower rather than oppress? Nigel Shadbolt and Roger Hampson have written a how-to for building ethical machine intelligence. Their new book, As If Human, Ethics and Artificial Intelligence, is now available wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to GeekWire. It's time for the Random Channel, that moment of the week when we talk about all of the random items that we were buzzing about behind the scenes this week. Monica Nicholsberg, what's your Random Channel item for this week?
I've been really captivated by BuzzFeed's big scoop on the Russia investigation this week and the fallout from it. The scoop was that BuzzFeed reported that Trump directed Michael Cohen, his longtime fixer, to lie to Congress about the company's dealings in Moscow and Russia. And it just, I've been fascinated with it more from a journalist's perspective because BuzzFeed's the only publication that ran with the story or that had the story. It was a scoop. And the special counsel's office put out a statement kind of denying it, but not with any specifics, which is so hard to do something with as a publication. And, I watched their editor-in-chief go on Nightly News, and he really fervently defended their reporting. He said they had it on from several sources. They stand by it. They're still reporting this story. They wished that the special counsel's office was more specific. But you just have to be really, you have to know they're really sweating as the only ones with a bombshell story like this, having it, their credibility questioned, and you having anonymous sources, so not really being able to do more than just say, we stand by it.
Do you believe it? It seems like something's off.
I think that reporters have a stronger motivation to get things right and tell the truth than special counsel investigators who have a whole host of other motivations.
Oh, really?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I this is all complete speculation, but I just, looking at it as an outsider, I think that serious journalists like the ones who reported this story, their due north is the truth. It's to get things right. They don't always get things right, but that is their main goal. And the special counsel's office, their main goal is to protect this investigation. I can see why they would want to manage their own timeline. So something may be off, but we just won't, we won't know, at least not in the immediate future. And I do feel bad for these reporters who are in this tough position.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was watching that BuzzFeed saga unfold last week, too. That was like Friday night that the special counsel released that statement late. And that, I think that BuzzFeed story came out Thursday night. And then BuzzFeed, to their credit, came back early this week, like Tuesday or so, with another story on how they had, you know, the hundreds or thousands of pages of documents showing that the plans for that Moscow tower were more than just casual conversations and sort of contradicted Rudy Giuliani and all his claims about how that it was going nowhere. It looked very much like it was headed somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, these stories are really complicated, and anonymous sourcing is really complicated, too, because you can't know the agendas of everyone who doesn't want to put their name to something. The other side of it is that Ronan Farrow put out a tweet or a statement saying that he declined to run with parts of the story because he couldn't substantiate them. So
interesting. Well, the one indisputable thing in all of this is that tower, it would have been spectacular.
Especially Putin's penthouse.
Oh my God. Yeah, that was the whole idea, was that they had specifically said they were not going to sell the condo on the top floors, like that they were going to reserve that for,
as a gift, right? For
Vladimir Putin.
Yeah.
And but like the interior of that, did you see like the atrium where it went across the stairs? It was there's no other word for it but tremendous.
Marble columns.
Exactly. Gold-plated. All right. Here's my random channel item. I've been a longtime fan of basketball. Folks who followed our new Numbers Geek podcast know that I've been digging into the numbers behind basketball. And this past week, I got a chance to talk with Sue Bird, the WNBA legend, about the numbers that matter to her. It's going to be on an upcoming episode of Numbers Geek. But the cool thing was, I've come across this game that I like to play with folks in these situations where I give them a document that I take key information away from, and then I have them explain how they would read that document that relates to their specialty, and then guess what the document is without the identifying information. So in Sue Bird's case, I gave her a stat sheet from a legendary college basketball game that figured largely in her emergence as a star, and it was so much fun. This is a giant tease because I'm not going to tell you any of it. I'm just going to tell you, subscribe to Numbers Geek, subscribe to the podcast. We talk about all sorts of cool government data, but we also have lots of fun with sports and entertainment. And Peter Sagal is going to be coming up soon as well, talking about the numbers behind running. Peter Sagal is the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and an avid runner and running columnist. So anyway, I'm having tons of fun with this podcast, Numbers Geek, with Steve Ballmer, the former Microsoft CEO and the founder of USA Facts, which is our partner on the podcast. And if you haven't checked it out, I'd invite you to do that at geekwire.com/numbersgeek.
I just like how fun it is for you to give someone a worksheet. You're thrilled by giving them puzzle homework.
It's not just a worksheet, Monica. It's a mystery. It's fun. Later on, I also gave Steve an income statement. I mean, if you want to talk about fun, when you get to the mystery.
I think income statement, I think fun.
Yeah, please.
The mystery income statement. Oh, my God. It's like you take away all the identifying characteristics of the company or any of the company's name and have him tell you how he reads an income statement and then try and guess which company it is. Anyway,
has anyone been better at it than Steve?
Not yet. No. I had to give Sue quite a few clues before she even recognized that it was one of her games, let alone which line was her. He's a wizard at it. He, in both cases that I've done this with him, he's figured it out with very minimal clues. And yeah.
I think at the end of Numbers Geek, we're going to have to turn the tables on you and see if you can figure out something.
Yeah. You could give me GeekWire's financials and I could try and tell you I don't know what year it was or something.
Yeah, story traffic arcs.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, that's my random channel item for the week. I'm also looking forward to the GeekWire Bash, and this should be your random channel, Kurt. So the GeekWire Bash is our annual festival, as I call it, our geek festival.
Geek carnival?
Yeah, I've banned the word carnival. It's a very controversial word inside the GeekWire offices. I've banned the word carnival. I think there's a negative connotation to carnival.
What is the negative connotation of carnival?
It's cheap, small town.
Huh. Oh, my God.
Right. Okay. All right.
No, I disagree.
All right. I like festival better. I like festival. It's because it's more of a festival. You've got three ping pong tournaments, dodgeball tournament, Settlers of Catan, foosball,
zip line,
virtual reality, video games, board games, you name it.
And for the first time this year, this giant event that we hold every year is going to be open to all ages. So, Kurt, your son and my daughter have beta tested this as kids in the past, and we've let them run around, even though it was kind of against the rules, but just to see how it would fly with kids. And we're going to have a junior geek zone this year. Your son loved it, right?
I highly recommend it. It's a great space for your kid just to sort of lose his mind and go explore. And with it sort of wide open and more kids there this year, hopefully, I think it'll be even more exciting in that regard. And the robotics challenge that we're hosting sounds like a neat thing for kids to sort of catch that bug.
Absolutely. So that's the GeekWire Bash. It's coming up on March 7th at CenturyLink Field Event Center in Seattle. You can find out more and get tickets at geekwire.com/bash. It's a very self-serving random channel item, but I got to tell you, I mean, both the Numbers Geek stuff and the GeekWire Bash, I'm all in on this stuff. So it's genuine. It's genuine.
We believe you.
Okay. All right. That's all I got. Anybody else got anything else?
I have nothing.
All right. Well, hey, it has been a lot of fun over the past few weeks. I think many of you know that we made the decision to no longer do a radio show every week. We're no longer on Cairo Radio. We are frequently on KUOW. Monica and I and Alan Boyle and others and Kurt are all on KUOW frequently. But I kind of like the fact that we don't have to worry about radio segments anymore. We can just sit here and talk, although we've reverted to our speed talking, Monica.
I just like that I can curse now. I mean, I don't think I have yet, but I like to have the option.
Yeah, the potential is there.
Really?
Right. Yeah.
You could have said that a half hour ago. light this thing up.
Yeah.
I just want freedom.
All right. With that, don't forget to subscribe to the GeekWire podcast if you haven't already. You can check out all of our podcasts at geekwire.com/podcast. And give us a rating and a review if you like the show, especially on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you listen. Until next time, I'm Todd Bishop.
I'm Monica Nicholsberg.
And I'm Kurt Schlosser.
Thanks for listening to GeekWire.